there's not really one single definition that everyone in the world agrees on, but there's, I think, a general understanding of what we would mean. It's the animal's well-being. So I think anyone working with animals is certainly thinking about physical health, which is part of welfare. But I'm interested broadly in what the animal experiences, and that's what a lot of scientists are focused on when we talk about welfare. So sickness, yes, but also other things they might feel. So trying to minimize negative emotions like fear and trying to make sure they have some positive experiences in their lives as well.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, Smacks Tech future-proofs your dairy operation. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status to deliver higher milk yield and carcass efficiency. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. The Dairy Podcast Show is brought to you by Wisenetics, and your host today, Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and I'm joined by Dr. Rebecca Maher, who is an associate professor in animal welfare at Dalhousie University in Canada. Dr. Maher, thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background, if you would. What got you into animal welfare and in the academic track?
Sure. Unlike a lot of people in this field, probably, I didn't really grow up on a farm. My mom was from a farming background, but I didn't grow up with it. But I was always interested in animals. So I did a degree in zoology, focusing on animal behavior. And then when I was looking into graduate programs, I found someone who was working on animal welfare, which was Georgia Mason, and she worked a lot with farm animals. And that really drew me in, that possibility of using these interesting things that I learned about animal behavior to actually make a difference in the lives of animals and apply it to a setting where I could affect a lot of animals.
Very cool. So where did you actually grow up?
In Kitchener, Ontario.
Okay. And then you did some of your graduate work in the UK, is that right?
My graduate work was in Canada, but I went and worked after that for a few years in the UK.
Gotcha. And how long have you been at Dalhousie University?
5 years this month.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about like what your main research areas of focus are? And you don't just do dairy cattle work, I guess.
Yeah, I work with a bit of a range of animals. So my PhD was actually with mink on fur farms, and I'm doing some of that again because we have a fur research center here at Dalhousie. But I've also worked a lot with dairy cattle since my postdoc. And I am interested in the fundamentals of how we actually measure animal welfare. So trying to understand what animals are experiencing and then in applying that. And I'm particularly interested in figuring out what kinds of environments we should be providing to them, particularly when they're young, because it can have long-term impacts on them.
Very good.
Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of SmartAmine M, the best in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain the lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
Well, maybe we should start by just explaining what exactly you mean when you talk about animal welfare. How do you define that?
Sure. So there's not really one single definition that everyone in the world agrees on, but there's, I think, a general understanding of what we would mean. It's the animal's well-being. So I think anyone working with animals is certainly thinking about physical health, which is part of welfare. But I'm interested broadly in what the animal experiences, and that's what a lot of scientists are focused on when we talk about welfare. So sickness, yes, but also other things they might feel. So trying to minimize negative emotions like fear and trying to make sure they have some positive experiences in their lives as well.
It's even difficult in humans, right? Like if you talk about things like pain and we have to rate things kind of on a subjective scale, right? So how do you even start doing that in an animal that can't directly answer a question?
Yeah, it's the big challenge that we're all dealing with in this field, that obviously we can't ask them directly what they feel, but we can tell a lot from their behavior. So we can ask them to make choices, and we can learn about certainly what they might experience as positive or negative by what they will choose. And with things like pain, we can then check, well, is it really pain, by doing things like giving them a painkiller drug and seeing if that changes the behavior.
Obviously, you know, one of the goals is to allow animals to express their natural behaviors, right? That's kind of one of the pillars of good animal welfare. But how do we, first of all, how do we define that? And then, you know, how do we assess that, whether they're actually able to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So mostly we define natural behavior by what the animal will do when they're not constrained by the environment or what we're doing to them. Mm-hmm. So with a lot of species, like with zoo animals, certainly we go to what they would do in the wild to figure out their natural behavior. The conversation gets a little bit more complicated with animals like cattle because they've been domesticated for so long. Some of those needs might have changed, but for the most part, they have the same basic behavioral motivation. So we can look at things like, well, when they're out on pasture, how would they spend their time when you're not actually doing things with them? And we talk about freedom to express their natural behavior as an important part of welfare, but mostly we mean the behaviors that they really are motivated to do that we think would be good for welfare. So there are things like defending themselves against a predator we don't necessarily need them to be able to do. If we can protect them from that, that's probably good.
Right.
But a lot of other behaviors are important to them.
Are there things we know we can do, like in a production setting, that are feasible that enhance an ability of an animal to express those behaviors?
Yeah, there's lots of things that we can do. So I think we know quite a bit about natural feeding behaviors and social behaviors to some extent in the adult cattle. And so we know things that we can do, like just providing them social contact is important. So some of the work I've done has been on things like the effects of having a social companion when they're young and making sure that they have enough resources that they can feed on their natural patterns and feed at the same time as other cows. So there's those very basic things that we're pretty well aware of. What I have been researching in recent years has been more the things that we haven't paid as much attention to in production settings, but things that we can work towards providing. So particularly I'm interested in natural hiding or seclusion behaviors and in exploration. So maybe things that aren't so much on a farmer's radar, but we do know, for example, that when cows want to give birth, that they naturally would separate themselves a little bit from the herd at that time. And then the calf usually hides a lot in the first couple of days while its mom is off grazing. And so I've been working with my colleague, Dr. Katie Proudfoot, who's in PEI, on that because she had worked on the cow side of that and whether they liked having a place that they could get away when they were actually going to calve. And so you can give like some sort of visual shelter in the pen that they can use. But we also looked at giving that to calves. So if the calves were going to stay in a pen with the cow and possibly with other animals around for a few days, would it be helpful to give them a little area where they could hide and maybe feel protected? And so we're just starting to understand how a dairy cow would use that. They did use it some, and it did seem to reduce stress when the mother was out of the pen for milking, possibly based on our physiological data, because we measured heart rate variability. But not all of the behavior results were exactly what we expected, so we need to do some more work on that. Mm. And then for exploration, it's something that actually gives animals a chance to experience positive emotions, maybe. We think it's one of the things that animals might naturally enjoy. We obviously can't directly measure that, but they seem to be motivated to do it. They have pretty limited opportunities on farms, but there's pretty simple things you can do, giving them little enrichments that they can interact with. And for dairy cattle, that's probably going to include things like scent. It might include things like different flavors. So I did a little study looking at whether they liked having different flavors in their feed, and we were just adding scents to TMR, basically. It wasn't changing the nutrition, just the smell of it. And not all of them liked it. On average, most of them would just eat their normal TMR, but some of them really did. And those were the most exploratory animals in other ways. So there are some fairly simple things you can think about if you want to give a little bit of variety in the environment that wouldn't be very expensive to do. And so we're just starting to think about ways that that could actually be put into practice.
That's fascinating. Well, let me dig into a few of those things. So from a very practical standpoint, the concept of letting cows and calves seek some isolation or some hiding away, like you said, with the calves. I've seen some farms actually implement that for the cows, right? And they often just put up plywood around a small pen. It's not super complicated. On the calf side, if you're doing like group housed calves, I assume that's the context you're talking about.
Yeah, so we were actually looking at it in a context where they were left with their mothers, but on most farms in North America, the group housed calves would be the more common situation. So I think it applies to both.
And what might that look like? Like a calf hutch within the pen?
Yeah, something like a hutch or even just a little wall. Like if you look at sow housing, if you've looked at the pig industry, they put in these sort of barriers that are just like a piece of plywood or a little wall that covers part way. And that gives them a chance to get away from each other if there is any conflict or if they're not feeling well and they want to be away from the group. So something like that might be possible to apply with calves and group housing.
Okay. And then you briefly mentioned social pairing or like paired housing with calves. And I feel like that's a practice that's sort of slowly being tested and implemented on some farms, and some farms report bad experiences and go away from it. And all, it's kind of at that point where it's being trialed out in the industry. Real briefly, I don't want to get way off on a sidetrack here, but, what are your quick takeaway points on the best practices there and what you expect the impacts to be long term from that effort?
I guess the impacts are, we expect improved welfare for them while they're together because they're getting to express natural behavior. And we've seen evidence that it reduces fearfulness, that maybe they can adapt better to new environments when they are put in larger groups later. And it actually even seems to affect their learning abilities. So if you teach them to do something and then change the rules on them, the calves are much more flexible if they've been raised socially. And that's, we looked at that in a very scientific way, but if you think about it on a farm where they're going to have to go into new pens, find food in new places, even learn to turn a different way going into the parlor or adjust to a robot milker, there's lots of things they need to learn. And so we want to set them up to be able to handle that. So I think that's the argument for why. And even in terms of things like growth and production, if the calves have a partner when they're young, they start eating solid food earlier, and that persists past when they're actually paired, even the ones that were housed individually. So it's maybe going to get your animals on track to be ready for breeding earlier, to grow better and therefore be healthier. So I think there's good reasons financially as well to be thinking about it. The problem is, I think, you have to have other things in your environment working well to make pair housing work. So if calves aren't being fed enough, then they're more susceptible to illness, but they're also more likely to start doing things like cross-sucking. And so you need to make sure that you're feeding them enough milk out of a teat, like a bucket with a teat, whatever system you're using, something that they can suck on other than the other calf. Have good hygiene and all of those things to make sure that it can work, because otherwise you can have those disasters and then people move away from the social housing.
And then in terms of enrichment, and I know some people on the nutrition side that have played with flavors and such in calf starter, is that mostly what you're talking about, calf starter?
That is where people have applied it so far yet, trying to get them eating more starter earlier. So that's one way that it could be used. But potentially, yeah, if animals aren't eating well for whatever reason, or just if you want to give them a new experience sometimes to get them used to things changing as the calves are growing, you can potentially add a scent to their hay or to their starter. And that just helps them adapt to that. So they might be less stressed or less likely to slow down their eating if they're exposed to some sort of feed change in the future.
One thing that came into my mind when you mentioned enrichment is, I mean, again, a very simple thing that's become fairly widespread is like the brushes, rotating brushes, or just this standalone brush. But part of your point, I think, is to introduce changes, right? So if you've got a brush in the pen with calves all the time, does that not really address what you're talking about?
It partly does, but I would like to see us go beyond that a little bit. So brushes, we know for sure they really like, and that's grooming as a natural behavior. So I think that's a good thing to have, and you don't want to take that away from them. Mm-hmm. So we actually looked a bit at whether it would be better to keep introducing different things to the pen or to have them all in there at once. And they used things more. It seemed to be more effective if they had everything at once.
Okay.
But yeah, so you can have a brush, but also think about what other behaviors they might want to do and things they might want to explore. So anything that they can manipulate and move around helps them learn about things and that things might react to them. So giving them a social companion is one of the big ways you can provide stimulation. But things like we gave them hay nets, like you would give to a horse, like slows down eating of the forage. And they used that a lot. They would eat from that even when they had a bucket of hay. Like they seem to like eating from the hay net. So they're just doing a slightly more complex behavior and they could headbutt it and play with it a little bit. So it was a fairly simple way of actually encouraging them to pay attention to the forage and actually giving them something that they could do in the pen.
So from a, I guess, a 20,000 foot view from, you know, thinking about the dairy industry as a whole, what do you think are the long-term impacts of trying to incorporate some of these efforts, I guess, with, you know, if our main goal is to just achieve natural behaviors, if you're somebody that's just trying to scrape a living out of a dairy farm, you know, what's the pitch to put some focus on this?
Well, I think anything that's going to help your calves develop more normally and to get eating well, to make them more adaptable to change, I think that's potentially going to have financial benefits. It's been hard to get the long-term research to actually demonstrate that, but we do have evidence that early growth correlates with success at first breeding and milk yield in the first lactation. So I think there's good reasons to be investing in trying to set our calves up well. And part of that is thinking about things like social contact so that they learn the right things and they'll work well on your farm later. Because it saves you labor, it saves you vet bills if the animals are more resilient and less likely to get sick. And it might help with things like production.
And I assume longer term part of this is the whole social license thing, right? We need to show to people that we care about the animals and want the best for them, right?
Of course. That's the other big reason that I think the industry really needs to be thinking about this. If we talk to the public, they are really concerned about natural behavior. That's where they see a lot of where animal welfare comes from. And their image of how a dairy cow should live is often very different from what someone in the industry sees. And we need to find some middle ground to say, hey, we're looking at this, we're looking at the evidence, we're looking at ways that we can improve their welfare on farms so that people are willing to keep consuming dairy products.
You brought up work on delaying cow-calf separation. I don't know for how long. I don't know if you want to talk through that, but I guess my bigger question is, you know, looking into your crystal ball 25 years from now, are there some practices that you think will be 100% expected then that are just kind of on the verge of feasibility today? Or how do you see things being different in terms of managing dairy cattle or dairy herds?
Yeah, I think that issue is one of the big ones that's on the horizon if we're talking that far down the road. Definitely, I think social contact for calves, and we're already transitioning to that with our code of practice in Canada. We're slowly moving towards younger social contact of some kind.
Okay.
We're far off from a lot of the industry doing cow-calf contact here, but it is being tried quite a bit in some parts of Europe and in Australia. People are trying to work on systems, knowing that that's one of the things the public really hates, is the baby cows being taken away from their mothers. So it's something that we're working on as researchers, thinking, yeah, 20, 25 years down the road, we might want systems for that. That might be what the industry needs to consider. And maybe it won't work for everyone, but I think we'll see more farms doing some form of that. Mm-hmm. So I have worked on it more. I've done literature reviews looking at what we know so far and finding really some of the arguments for separating them, like protecting the health of the calf. There's not as much evidence as you think there is. There's maybe not a strong reason for the early separation in a lot of cases. There are things like active yonis where you might have to consider it. But for a lot of things, it might actually work out better. Things like mastitis might be improved in the cows if you're leaving them with the calf, and it might be fine for the calf's health. We're just starting to figure out what it will do to the calves in terms of their welfare and their long-term performance. And there's a lot of practical things to work out about how to manage milking and how to keep the calves from getting sick and all of those things. So it is down the road, but I think that is something that is quite possibly coming to more of the industry.
Just a completely ignorant question. If tomorrow, you know, you were helping a farm that had to implement delayed cow-calf separation, what would be the age that you would separate them to minimize the downsides, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we know that if you leave them more than a couple of days, they're going to be bonded and there's going to be stress at separation. So I think we need to then leave them together long enough for them to get some major benefits. And certainly in the first couple of weeks, their mom is an important social partner. And that's when drinking from the mother, getting on a natural feeding pattern, all of those things might be important. So I think a lot of places are looking at things like the milk feeding period, like 6 weeks, 8 weeks, maybe, if they want to do that.
Okay.
But yeah. Not all farms are going to be ready to start with that. It might be as simple as starting with a few days, let them nurse from their mother, let them get used to that before you move them. But yeah, down the road, I would say we're probably looking at milk feeding period, most likely, that people would be targeting.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, from a very practical standpoint, if you're going to deal with co-housing, you may as well at least get rid of feeding milk to calves every day, right? Like,
yeah,
that could be a
labor and the mixing of milk replacer and all of that. Yeah, you can get rid of that. So I think that would be the ideal if we can find good systems to make it work.
Well, I'm glad people are working on that. It's an important question.
Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. Asepsis LLC is a Wisconsin-based animal wellness company focused on the development of state-of-the-art animal hygiene technologies. Our company's mission is to apply innovative hygiene solutions into animal agricultural and veterinary applications, improving the wellness of the animals with a focus on sustainability. We accomplish this through the continued enhancement of our chlorine dioxide-based technologies within a wide range of agricultural hygiene applications, from facility and animal hygiene to water treatment.
So just a very big picture question. I mean, like me, you work at the university, you interact with people every day that know next to nothing about agriculture. If there was one thing that you wanted to communicate to people about the dairy industry, good or bad, that they maybe don't perceive correctly, what would that be?
There are a lot of small things. I'm not sure what the big thing would be. I mean, to the people who are really opposed to the industry, I think I just want to communicate that the farmers do care about their animals. Like, you don't work in this industry if you don't care about the animals. So I think some people have a misconception that because it's a business, people don't care at all and they're not paying attention to this stuff. And that's not a good starting point for having any conversations or improving anything. So that's an important thing. But as a scientist, I think a lot of the frustration also comes from people misunderstanding what the animals might actually want. And so trying to communicate that actually we need to ask the animals what their choices are and not just go by what we think they would like is an important concept to get across.
Yeah, I think it can be hard. You know, somebody maybe has worked with dairy cattle for 50 their whole lives, right? And they're like, oh, I know.
Yeah.
But it's a very conditioned perception, right? Because you grow up interacting with them in a very specific way of managing, and you know how they respond to those pressures, but you don't really necessarily look at it from a bigger picture.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm guilty of that sometimes.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach. Trow Nutrition, North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Natural Biologics is using cutting-edge science to deliver cost-effective solutions for the animal health and productivity challenges you face. For conventional or organic production systems, Natural Biologics can help support rumen health and immune function, mitigate pathogens, and increase production efficiency. Visit naturalbiologics.com to learn more.
Well, it's time for the three hardest questions of the day for you. We throw these at everybody. It's always interesting to see what they say. So first of all, what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
It's hard to narrow down to one for me, and obviously I'm focused on behavior and welfare, so I think I'll put in a plug for The Welfare of Cattle book by Jeff Rushen and a group of authors. That's sort of one of my go-to resources that goes through things like housing and feeding systems and how they affect welfare and behavior of the animals. But there's also lots of good resources out there for people in the industry online for free. Like the Ontario government has some really good fact sheets. Mm-hmm. The scientific committee report for the code of practice here in Canada gives a really good overview of what we actually know about some of the hot issues in the industry right now. So I think those are useful things for people to look at.
Okay, what about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
The honest answer for my favorite book is nothing that's going to be very relevant to dairy industry people. I wouldn't call it a resource, but I'm a bit of a classic literature nerd. So Jane Austen, Persuasion probably is my favorite book.
Very good. And then in your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
I think there's a number of factors, but one I would say that is important to most careers, but definitely for the dairy industry, is just willingness to learn. Being curious about what's out there and willing to think about other perspectives. We know the industry is always changing and there's always new information coming out. And I think the people who are interested in that and willing to think about different ways of doing things are the ones who are going to be able to successfully adapt and keep going in the future.
Well said. And hopefully that's the people that are taking the time to listen to a podcast to learn a few things, right?
I would think so, yeah.
All right. Well, again, Dr. Rebecca Mahar, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a fascinating conversation.
Great. Thank you.
This has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. Don't forget to subscribe or like this so that you see the next episode when it comes out. And this is Barry Bradford signing off.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.